All right, everybody, welcome to the April 9th edition of Cascadian Views. I'm Brock here with Dan and JJ as our normal crew this week. How's it going, guys?
Hello.
Hey, howdy, doing all right?
This was a week where a lot changed in a lot of different categories. We have, I think it's fair to say, open hostilities in Syria at this point. Trump is... did a complete 180 on one of his campaign promises and one of his biggest issues for him. I know we talked briefly a couple weeks ago. I can't remember if we talked in the show, but we talked in the Facebook group about ground troops arriving in Syria to operate mortars as a way to help out the opposing forces. We have now directly committed hostile actions against the Syrian regime and their armed forces, the Syrian Arab Army. This was in somewhat direct result of the Assad chemical weapons attack. Preliminary results, I believe, pinned it on sarin nerve gas on a civilian population, nearly 200 casualties. Images of children dying in the streets were widely circulated on cable news and in the media. And it apparently is what prompted Trump to do his... well, I'm going to call it a flip-flop just because that's the political parlance, but I've never really liked that phrase. I want my leaders to adjust to situations as the situations themselves change and not be stuck in one mode. However, it has kicked off a bit of talk of betrayal from the alt-right. I know we had a rather extensive discussion, or at least JJ and I did. I don't think you ever popped up, Dan, about kind of what this means and where we stand on it, and I have to say I don't think he went about it the right way, particularly with these news stories that the base is already back in business. But I think I've reached a point where just something had to have happened to Assad. These, I believe this is the fifth or the sixth confirmed chemical attack that's gone on in the civil war at this point. It's almost never targeting the military. It's targeting rebel-held areas as a whole, including mostly civilians. This is something I don't think we've really seen at this level since World War One, I believe.
There had to have been some kind of... What about Saddam Hussein in the 80s?
You know what? Actually,
in
you're
any
right.
Case. Yeah.
You're correct. You gassed the Kurds.
Excellent. Both Iran and Iraq in the 80s, because we sold them both chemical weapons and they used them on each other.
Right.
Well, playing both sides.
There you go. Anyhow, my thought is I don't think the alt-right is entirely unjustified in feeling a bit betrayed by all this. I mean, you've mentioned that it's good that political leaders should respond and change in response to changing circumstances. I have a hard time seeing what's changed, unfortunately. I don't mean to be cavalier or callous, but it's been... Oh, my goodness, I'm sorry. That was my phone. I need to... Anyhow, it's not really something that... It's not a situation that's changed. Assad has been committing atrocities going back to 2011, really, since the Civil War got started. I think a lot of people are...
I think you can go back to 04.
Exactly.
Look that up, but I believe 04 is one of his first major attacks on his own citizenry.
And that was immediately after he took power, was 2004.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a terrible ruler who has been doing terrible things for as long as his population has been subject to him. I think, again, not to be callous, but it looks like Trump saw the attacks on TV, saw footage, and being the impulsive person that he is, decided that that was what had sunk into his brain, and so he was going to do something about it, even if it was bombing an empty airfield and telling the Russians and the Syrians first that he was going to do it.
The Politico piece I leaked inside Trump's 3 days of debate on Syria paint almost exactly that picture, which was this was a very impulsive move on his part. And interestingly, I think the response to this has not been particularly partisan. There are people who are very, I don't want to say happy for, but supportive of the strike on both the Democratic and Republican fronts, and there are people opposed to it, once again, on both the Democratic and Republican fronts. It's a decision that seems to cut less of an ideological jib, if you will.
Or at least less of a partisan jib. I think there's certainly some ideology there, particularly the folks like John McCain, Lindsey Graham. They certainly have an ideological bent towards U.S. intervention, for good or ill. They see it as a force for good. And then among the folks that are opposed, particularly on the right, there's been an affinity not just for Putin, but for Assad for a very long time. A lot of factors going into that, but part of it is his ongoing hostilities with Israel, the idea that he protects Christians within the borders of Syria while attacking Sunni Muslims. There's a lot that goes into it. There is some ideology, but yeah, you're right. It cuts across both partisan lines, certainly. I didn't see. Was there a statement by Hillary Clinton in support, or was that something old?
I believe there was a statement by, it may not have been the Clinton campaign, but it was people associated with it, that Trump should consult with Congress. But she has been, including just a few hours before Trump ordered the strike, generally supportive of attacks on Assad.
Yeah. Or at least, during the campaign, she was speaking very strongly for a no-fly zone, which is something that's time has probably passed at this point, but definitely more aggressive towards Assad and his Russian supporters than either Trump was expected to be or Barack Obama was.
We made this point in the conversation too, but Obama named chemical weapon usage during the Civil War as a red line. And then following the use of chemical weapons, back down from that position, largely as just a political reality. I don't want to be too, hard on him there, although I do think it was a particularly telling failing of his presidency. I don't know if it's entirely up to him on that. Congress was a Republican-held Congress, insistent on opposing anything Obama did, was more than a little bit pushy politically, preemptive court cases in order to try and force him to get authorization, and then denied that authorization to him. And Obama didn't really seem to want to rock the boat. In the end, though, the end result of that was that we backed down in the face of a petty dictator gassing his own population. And I think that has harmed the U.S. and its moral image across the world in a lot of ways. I don't know if this action fixes it, though. I really don't. Particularly, another piece I linked from Lindsey Graham, who, in language that I think only somebody from the South could really pull off in this day and age, said that Assad was giving Trump a big FU by using the bombed base again. He had already deployed his planes to it. Trump did notify the Russians about the strike a little bit before it happened, at which point the Russians, working quite closely with the Syrian regime, helped them move all their stuff out. So it was really just facilities that were hit. It wasn't actual, weapons of war. This is a touchy one. And JJ, something that you linked in the thread actually gave me a lot to think about, and it was about the use of barrel bombs in this war, and the extreme number of them. Barrel bombs are very crude bombs. The name,
they are terrifying ordnance. Good God.
Wikipedia basically describes them as flying IEDs. They're basically just a big metal shell stuffed with whatever high explosives you can find, some stuff to create shrapnel, and then dropped out of a plane with no guidance, literally flying barrels. They have largely been banned. I mean,
think of it. It's an oil drum. It's an oil drum full of, you know, high octane gasoline and some shrapnel.
Oh my God.
Like yeah. That's the metal casing. That's why it's a barrel bomb. It's just a bunch of big oil drums. And yeah, they, I mean, there's footage on YouTube. Well, there used to be, it's probably off YouTube now, but, it was about 3 years in and yeah, they just fly a helicopter, then it was in Homs. They just fly helicopters over the city and, just light the wick and push them out the side of the helicopter. It was one of the ways that they, you know, it's a crude bunker buster in many respects because it will just eat right through an apartment building.
I was, that piece really recontextualized some things for me, and it made me examine a little bit more about myself as well, because it points out that the extensive use, almost, I believe it was a couple hundred thousand, if I'm remembering that right.
I want to say 11,000 last year.
Okay, wow. 13,000. I had that wrong, yeah. Wow. But these attacks, and they are horrific and they are terrible weapons, don't produce in me, at least, that same visceral reaction that using chemical weapons does. And I don't think they're less horrible. In fact, they seem to have killed a lot more people during the Syrian civil war, but I don't have this sort of instinctual revulsion. I recognize intellectually they're terrible, but there is a physical reaction that happens in me when I see these pictures of the aftermath of something like sarin gas, which disconnects the neurons between your head and your lungs so that you can't tell your lungs to breathe and you lay there and suffocate. It's, for me, difficult to really pin down why there is that difference when you look at the death numbers from this, which the barrel bombs are astronomical. There were 13,073 individual attacks on vital facilities using barrel bombs in Syria just last year on civilian infrastructure.
Yeah, including, I believe, 23 hospitals and, like, what was it, 97 other structures classified as civilian, refugee camps, places of worship, and schools being the top three things that the article mentions as examples. And yeah, it brings up a really interesting question and a point, which is why, you know, why I posted that article as something that we think about in how we classify certain acts of war, that certain, you know, chemical and biological weapons, there's at this point a long-standing treaty in the UN regarding this ordinance, and it's expected that most parties will hold to this. It's worth noting that barrel bombs also have a UN Security Council resolution, though that was only agreed upon 3 years ago.
And I do want to point out that only is banning their use in the Syrian civil war. It was a conflict-specific resolution.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this a type of ordinance that's been used in many other conflicts, or was that really why the focus here was, you know, just because this is something that's being used that's making this conflict particularly terrible?
It has a very kind of spotted history, if you will. Huh. It actually, so the very, very first use of barrel bombs was actually by Israel in the original 1948 Arab-Israeli War, and that was mostly out of necessity. Israel was a very new country. I believe at that point they had only been a country for a few days when they were attacked collectively by their Arab neighbors and without a whole lot of, you know, state planning that can be done in, you know, less than a week. There wasn't a whole lot of a military, so these were very much improvised weapons. Following that, nobody really used them for about 20 years. And then during the Vietnam War in the late 60s, the U.S., deployed it as crude but effective weapons against the guerrillas in the forest. It was a great way to take out a large area of forest in once, especially because it didn't look so nasty on the news as, say, raining down napalm did. Following that, pretty much every, I guess, Western or liberal democratic society has kind of swore off them. They've only come up in less structured conflicts, let's say.
Yeah, largely yeah. In civil wars in the global south, with the exception of the Serb Croatian conflict in the 90s.
Exactly, the falling apart of Yugoslavia. Aside from that, it's all been in the Middle East or the Southern Asia region.
So, a nasty conflict exactly like the present one in Syria that just has no likely end, no defined good guys, bad guys, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they're a very cheap... Wikipedia cites them as costing between $200 and $300. So they're a remarkably cheap anti-personnel area clearing ordnance.
The use of barrel bombs and these attacks in civil war has been almost exclusively, not quite, but almost exclusively the province of the Syrian regime and, surprisingly to me, actually, their Russian allies. According to the Syrian Network for Human Rights, a activist group that monitors the conflict, in 2016, the Syrian regime was responsible for just over 55% of barrel bomb attacks. The Russian forces operating in their country were responsible for nearly 32%. The on-the-ground internal opposition in Syria was responsible for 4%. The international coalition was responsible for 3%. Other parties that aren't listed are responsible for 3%, and Islamist groups, almost surprising to me, only 2.3%. And all but one of those was ISIS. Fatah al-Sham launched a single attack. So
yeah, and just to get back to your earlier point, Brock, about, you know, Obama's handling or mishandling of this, like...
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, there's no way in which bombing this situation ends up fixing any problems. It's not that I support Assad at all, and you know, much as I said in our more public posts and public discussion on this, like, that dude sucks. That dude's been needed to get got for as long as he's been a person to get got.
Mm-hmm.
Bombing an airstrip obviously was completely useless. You know, we just spent like $30 million to put a hole in the dirt that they filled over in 24 hours. So, you know, go America. Fuck yeah. We dug a hole and they filled it. And then given all of the other context of the situation, you know, it's not, this has unified Putin and Assad, at least, you know, openly and diplomatically, for, you know, further cemented their union, as well as with Iran, if I recall correctly, who's also made statements that our attack was illegal and irresponsible and will only exacerbate the situation, which, I mean, of course, is, for those who don't follow these kinds of international incidents, often this is, you know, par for the course. This would be the common rhetoric that you would always hear around these sorts of issues. But there's really not much of a play for the U.S. here. Like, either we double down and we do what Lindsey Graham suggests and put boots on the ground, or we don't do much at all anymore. And either way, the decision is fraught with absolutely nothing but hardship, largely for the Syrian people.
I don't think that there would be any easy outs on here, but I think if there was going to be one, it was earlier. when the Syrian free army needed help, basically. We created this weird opposition to Assad that has linked up with groups like ISIS because they needed resources in the beginning, and the only ones with those resources that experienced was ISIS. And so we have this weird thing where fighting side by side are the people we hate and the people we nominally support, and both of them are fighting together against this other dude that we don't support. And it's a very complicated situation. I think letting it fester as the world did, because we're not the only world's police, although I do think we had to shoulder a burden there, nobody engaged on this. Everybody just kind of left them to it and created this disgusting octopus of death with tentacles reaching into every corner.
Yeah, I assume that whatever moderate or reasonable political group was around was already corporately aligned with Russia, which made corporate alignment to U.S. interests difficult. So nobody in the West really wanted to bother because there wasn't money to be made.
Well, also, I mean, at least from the very start, I mean, Assad has been a Russian client, and that's kind of the biggest possible danger of going ahead and trying to dislodge him, you know, because
it's a multi-decade alliance. It's not going anywhere.
It brings you into conflict with a superpower, you know, which is, I can't see how that has a happy ending.
Still sees it as a superpower.
Right, right. There's the debate as to, you know, where it stand, they stand economically. They certainly have a fairly fearsome military and nuclear capacity, so it's not like we're going to be going to war with them. But
just to play devil's advocate, didn't we basically do that for about 40 years? I mean, wasn't that Korea and Vietnam and all those conflicts? You know, the original invasion of Afghanistan, where we supported the Mujahideen.
We
have proxy wars. We sell arms to a rebel group to just mess with the Ruskies.
In the hottest instances, you know, American troops fight Russian proxies and Russian troops fight American proxies. I mean, but they don't occupy the same ground and fight each other is where it.
Yeah.
Even at the hottest, you know, it's not like you had, you know, Soviets and Americans exchanging gunfire. And, you know, here we, on short notice, we bombed an airbase that had a bunch of Russians on it. You know, so thank goodness. I mean, people make fun of Trump for calling the Russians and letting them know that the bombs were coming. But, you know, thank goodness that he did, because I can't imagine the level of escalation that would happen if he did happen to kill a bunch of Russian soldiers in a raid like this.
Yeah, very true.
I am almost, and I hate to go here because of my extreme dislike for conspiracy theorists, but this was suspiciously timed in order to make it look like Trump and Putin were not bestest buddies. I don't know if anybody has really thought about that, but right when the Russian story was reaching something of a fevered pitch, Flynn asking for immunity, the New York Times has reported that the CIA was well aware of the Trump connection during the campaign, and back in October had already discovered that Trump associates were working with the Russian government, but had to hold back because that's the FBI's job when you're investigating an American. This is a story that took a lot of the air out of cable news and moved it onto something that was not Trump's troubles.
Yeah. That's certainly, you know, a possibility that kind of lingers in the back of my mind. It was very helpful for Trump to do that at that time, as far as those particular problems for him. As a bonus, it gets cable news and pundits all over talking about what a great, strong leader he is because he launched a bunch of missiles somewhere halfway around the world. you know, who knows why or for what purpose or what's going to come next. The important thing is that, you know, the president sends missiles, and since he did it, that makes him the president.
Yes, God, our standards are so low. It's yeah. so sad. Oh, it's so presidential. Oh, Jesus.
I feel that there's probably several hours of content to milk from that topic, but I am going to kind of slide us on just in the interest of keeping us on track here and talk sure. a little bit about what that story was distracting us from at the time, which is a middle, possibly the middle, possibly the end, depending on what Steve Bannon chooses to do, part of a huge, at least at this early stage, staff shakeup at the White House. Notably, most of the alt-righters seem to be getting shoved to the side a little bit. Katie McFarland is out at the National Security Council. This was a holdover from Flynn, somebody who the Washington establishment has been trying to force out for quite a while. McMaster, as the new National Security Advisor, was able to kind of force this through. And apparently Rebus and Bannon are under the gun as well. It's been reported in numerous outlets that Bannon is on the verge of being kicked out, that Trump basically told him he needs to play nice. This comes on the heels of stories that Bannon had to be talked out of resigning over being kicked off the National Security Council. Is this,
despite not previously having attended meetings.
Yeah.
Right.
Is this something where, you know, there's smoke and there's eventually going to be fire, or is this just more of the sniping coming from inside the White House? Because Bannon and Kushner have famously got into it a little bit. I posted a link to our Facebook group about Bannon calling Kushner a cuck behind his back, which seems to be the favorite insult of the alt-right white nationalist wing.
Mm-hmm. So I think you probably got a couple of things going on. You mentioned a lot of the change to the National Security Council, and I think that's probably its own track. As you mentioned, General McMaster was appointed to replace Michael Flynn after he had to resign. And what I think part of the task that's confronted him over the last month or so since taking the job is Flynn, not to, well, let's just call it what it is. Flynn is a crazy person. He's completely nuts.
A wacko, a nut
a
job.
A whack job, yeah. He's not right in the head.
Than squirrel shit.
And he brought a lot of nuts along with him to staff the National Security Council. And McMaster has been slowly, you know, picking his way through them and pulling them away, sometimes against resistance from Trump himself and, you know, Bannon and, you know, other folks in Trump's inner circle, but just making the case that he's got an important job to do and he can't do it with all of, you know, these nuts like the one that is on the way out today. It was
McFarland?
McFarland, yes. Also, Cohen Watnick, who was the big guy from the scandal last week, all of these folks are getting in the way of doing the important work of keeping the country safe. That includes Bannon, too. And so I expect a lot of this is him making the case that he needs to have a professional National Security Council that he can run. So I think that's one thing. And then the other, I suspect, just relates to the general misfortune and difficulty that the administration has had. Couldn't get their health care bill through. Trump is historically unpopular. There's probably, you know, with all that going on, I would guess there's a lot of infighting and differing points of view on how they can make that better. And as they fight that out, some people are going to end up shouldering the blame. And I would guess that Bannon's probably taking a lot of it, and probably rightly so.
The president.
Yeah, quite a few stories and comedians have been mocking the story that Trump does not appreciate the insinuations from the press that Bannon is running everything.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the reverse Cheney. Like, Bush was ego, amused, right? By those reports that Cheney was the puppet master. He right. thought that they were funny. Trump is like genuinely hurt by these. He feels threatened. It's a very strange dynamic.
For a shallow man that's all about image, pomp, and circumstance, it really is the best way to hit him.
Mm-hmm.
He has no defense, and it just goes right to the bone for him every time.
And these were somewhat self-inflicted wounds for Bannon. He worked fairly hard to create that impression that he was the power behind the president. Even, I believe, referred to himself as the president to a reporter at one point when he was getting pissed off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's not having insight into your boss's psychology there, I'd say. Wow.
Right?
Or at least having a big blind spot about it.
I mean, and then also just, you know, nobody's going to love you if you're in government and your whole goal is to just burn it down.
Yeah.
I mean, they love Reagan because all government was bad government and we had to straighten out, you know, the bad hombres, to use the common parlance of our current celebrity president. But for most America, burning the system down is still way too far.
Yeah, the first time that somebody's grandma's Social Security check doesn't arrive in the mail on time is the end of whatever government shutdown we would ever have. Yeah. There's just too much at stake for most people to really take that burn it down, get rid of it all line to its logical conclusion. There's a lot of people who might say they like that, but when push comes to shove and consequences start piling up, I don't think it holds water for very long.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why people like Paul Ryan, because Paul Ryan really does want to burn it down, but he's going to do it like an accountant. He's going to nickel and dime that whole building until there's nothing but kindling, and then he'll just walk away and set the match. I see Paul Ryan really is no less nihilistic about government than Bannon is. They just go about it very, very differently. One goes about it like an alcoholic, and the other one goes about it like an accountant.
He favors the controlled demolition.
Yes, exactly.
This is notable because of how much the Bannon bitching at the other staff members have really gotten over. We talked about proxy wars a little bit ago. There's been a proxy war between Kushner and Bannon playing out openly in the press for the last couple weeks, with both camps, you know, planting their own stories, and notably Breitbart going to bat hard for their old boss, including something that you don't really see, a conservative media outlet harping the Russia, you know, Putin Trump story. Kushner apparently lied on his federal form for security clearance. He had to detail all the contacts he had had with foreign officials for the last, I think it was 7 years or 12 years, one of those numbers. And the one that we now know about, where he met with Russian business interest and one of the Russian ambassadors in the Seychelles, was not disclosed. He confirmed that he had had no meetings, and it later came out that he had had meetings with those people. Breitbart has jumped all over that as a way to knock Kushner. It's
sure, any weapon at hand. Yeah,
Talking Pone's memo has called it the alt-right snuff novel, in terms of the battle between the original alt-right that feels jilted and Trump's new crew. Tillerson at Secretary of State is turning out to be more of a moderate than many people noticed. Bannon apparently can't stand him. He calls most of these people New York Democrats, which is somewhat coded language. New York has been used as a label to apply to Jews for many, many decades now. And that's not really lost on anybody.
Rather ironic, given that he was a New York banker.
Yeah.
Right.
Kushner is a practicing Jew. Cohn, who is one of the more moderate members of Trump's team and one of the more respected members of Trump's team, is a former Goldman Sachs banker who also happens to be Jewish. So these anti-Semitic overtones, I think, are less overtones and more quite explicit at this point.
Yeah, God, those meetings must be so phenomenally tense. I mean, and yeah, with, you know, with Trump bringing both his daughter and Kushner in very, very closely, you know, very deeply involved in the White House, like, and the media decidedly seems to love them more than anybody else in the administration. Versus, of course, Bannon, who looks, acts, and speaks like
the dude in the alleyway behind your Starbucks asking for change so he can buy a handle.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so, again, for a narcissist like Trump, who's all about the shallow image, his daughter and her husband really are the better first couple. Like, they're a better image. They speak well, but they speak more articulately than the actual first couple.
They also politically are much more moderate. In fact, Kushner is, I believe, until he came aboard with the Trump team, was a registered Democrat.
Yeah, I think both of them were prior to Trump running. So yeah, like they're definitely far more palatable to the general populace. So I see a lot of that in their big movement up and Bannon's fall. I mean, aside from the fact that he's a gross, disgusting pile of like Axe body spray and beard shavings. So, I mean, like, nobody's ever going to love him or even tolerate his, like, basic presence. He can't really be the face of anything other than what he was, Breitbart. Like, he the face of a magazine and a newspaper that doesn't show his face. Like, that's the only place he'll be loved.
I think he has a bright future as the face of alcohol abuse in America. Have you seen how far that, like, rosy nose has spread?
Yeah,
he's just got a red like hole in the front of his face now.
Yeah, he looks like one of those monkeys, like with the big red face.
I think it's a macaque. Specifically told me that he himself blames that on whiskey consumption. By the way, like, we're not just making this up.
I mean, I don't feel like we need to. I mean, if he hasn't openly said that he's, you know, been a member of AA for 20 years. He's in politics and journalism and Wall Street banking. Yeah, he's an alcoholic. And probably addicted to cocaine and a few other things. Like, unless it's been denied and that denial has been confirmed, I assume abuse and addiction from somebody in those professions.
There were talks, stories more out of Breitbart that he basically told the staff that he had spent most of the 80s and early 90s being an alcoholic. So I'd take that with what you will.
which of course would imply that has curbed.
I think he implied that.
Nobody actually thinks that.
No, nobody can see him. Yeah.
It's just silently cry drinking in the closet of the White House.
Trump got involved in the Middle East. You'll never leave me, no. Jim Beam.
Oh, man.
Well, on that little bit of lighthearted news, at least we got some laughs out of that. It wasn't all depressing. We'll turn around and focus local a little bit here. I'll start in Oregon just because there's more going on up in Washington and more that we'll talk about, I'm sure. A very small, quick piece. I actually knew about this a couple weeks ago, but I haven't been following up on what would happen. We are apparently advancing a constitutional amendment to the ballot this year to decide whether or not the Oregon Constitution should continue to ban duels. And let me tell you, this is something that I have very strong feelings about. Extremely strong.
This is the best piece of legislation I've ever seen in my life. And I was blown away that we legalized weed. But man, this is a better step in the right direction. Let's bring back the duel. Yeah.
Yeah. You got a list, man. Yeah, exactly.
So banning dueling was a...
No, and it's a ban on dueling by public officials, which of course means that individual citizens who have no aspirations for public office are already free to duel in Oregon. But if you want to run for office, you're going to have to pass this bill first, and then it's on. I mean, I want to move to Oregon, have a duel, and run for public office just because I'll be able to in a year.
It was in vogue for several decades for states coming into the union to ban duels. I would imagine, and I haven't actually done the historical research on that, but I would imagine it was because of, well, what the article mentions, the famous duel between Vice President Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, the Secretary of the Treasury. Burr ended up killing Hamilton and subsequently having to spend some time on the run before being captured. It was a little bit of a national travesty, made us look rather stupid, especially as a country that was, what, 10 years old at the time. Your vice mm-hmm. president should not be walking around killing folks. And this caused a bit of introspection.
I mean, it was the right move. Alexander Hamilton was a total douche. I mean, Aaron Burr was in the right. I think it was an overreaction at the time. I just want to throw that out there.
In the early days of Wikipedia, I put quite a bit of effort into a very fancy, very large page with very strict rules. It was a list of sitting U.S. vice presidents that had shot somebody.
Yes.
Made it very clear that it couldn't be somebody who had been vice president and then later shot somebody, or somebody who shot somebody before becoming vice president, but just sitting vice presidents, and that list was Aaron Burr and Dick Cheney. Because, you know, it was 2005, and that was funny at the time.
But Alexander Hamilton didn't apologize to Aaron Burr, so...
Well, he died. I mean, so Dick Cheney tried to come out as a hard ass, but he was really second fiddle there, man. Burr killed his dude. So,
do you suggest that that was enough of an apology? Like, just keeling over? Like, he...
Fine.
Everybody knew right. what that really meant. You were right, man.
You know, if Cheney had still been on his second heart, maybe he would have been able to pull the trigger. That was the tough heart. He got soft in his later years.
Oh my God.
You'd go in with the killing shot. You know, loaded him up with birdshot first, needed to go in with a pistol.
The Oregonian, when they published this story about the consideration of the constitutional ban on duels being overturned about a month ago, I believe, they had a listing of all the states that banned dueling in their constitution. And it was pretty much all of them between about 1830 or so and about 1870 or so. And after that, people just kind of stopped mentioning it, which leads me to believe it was probably tied to the Aaron Burr thing. And as soon as that kind of faded from public memory, states stopped really caring about this so much.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, at least from movies and whatnot, one would have it believed that the duels became kind of a problem here in the West, where it was just like, my eggs aren't properly cooked. Let us duel it. Just like murder spree. Because that was the way that you could murder people legally, I guess. Because it was a gentleman's agreement or something, even though nobody ever won a gentleman from it. Yeah, I wonder how many people just constantly died of dueling. All of this lawmaking suggests to me that it was really a serious enough problem.
I am curious enough about that to actually see if I can look it up quickly. U.S. deaths by dueling. They have some list of famous deaths by duels. How often do people die in duels during the 18th century? Let's ask Quora. I do not verify the veracity of these numbers, but we'll check it out. Andrew Jackson apparently fought in 103 duels in his life, so if you take that as an average, it's pretty high.
Holy crap. Wow. Okay, so maybe not everybody had a problem, but obviously there were a couple of individuals that had a serious fucking dueling problem. God, why didn't anybody just whack Jackson? Just like, in an alleyway, like, no duels, bro. Like, this dude's way too good. Like,
was Jackson the one who got a donkey drunk at his inauguration? I want to say that was him.
Yeah. I would believe you. I mean,
he's Trump's caliber president, so.
Yeah. I am unfortunately very distantly related to that man.
Wow.
We've had conversations about
it's
Trump's spirit president before, because he has pictures of Jackson and Jefferson, who are notably considered the two founding fathers of the Democratic Party. Neither one of them great dudes. I'm content to leave Jackson in the dustbin of history. I will go to bat a little bit for Jefferson, but not too far. He was at least not genocidal. I'll leave it at that.
He had some fleeting redeeming qualities. I'm led to believe that Jackson's redeeming quality was his rampant alcoholism, and like that was the best thing he had.
Oh my god.
Other than that, I mean, I guess the best thing about him was that he was a duel master, because he slayed 103 dudes in duels. So,
and only lived to be 78, so that's more than one a year.
Wow.
That's, well, considering also his, you know, I'm assuming he didn't start until he was an adult, but who knows? Then you're talking probably an average of two a year or more.
Start a Chuck Norris type meme about Andrew Jackson dueling people at two. This man's unbeatable.
Jackson's inauguration included 20,000 spectators who ended up storming the White House and the hotel that they were holding it at.
Still bigger crowd than Trump.
Ripping apart buildings, getting drunk, and officials were only able to clear them out and begin cleaning up the White House by moving the bowls of liquor and punch outside, and the crowd followed them.
Whoa. His inauguration was a frat party.
Basically.
And they had to haul the trough outside.
I believe a hootenanny. A hootenanny is the term for it. Yeah.
A fraternal organization's hootenanny.
Jackson also was the one with the big block of cheese from Big Block of Cheese Day.
That's true. That's the one I think he did.
I don't really think he did that. It was presented with that big block of cheese.
Oh, that's right.
He had to find a way to get rid of it. Yeah.
Oh. Well, the manner in which he did was clever. He probably dueled everybody who showed up to have cheese.
You know what? That would be a little self-defeating, JJ. If he, you know, defeated everybody who came to get his cheese, nobody would eat his cheese, and he'd still have that 2-ton block of cheese in the White House.
No, no. They eat the block of cheese while they're standing in line waiting to be killed.
Right. He waits until they're all logy after they eat the cheese.
Yeah. And that's when he just, like, sets upon you. And he's like, duel time. Okay, go. Bam. I win. Jackson rules.
That pumps up the numbers, certainly. Yeah.
All right. Let's go a little north of the border, finally, to Washington with two things. One is something we talk about fairly often, and that's, in general, what a horrible, horrible, horrible person Doug Erickson is.
But start,
we'll leave that one for the end as a little bit of a palate cleanser, because there's a bit of a tabloidy story, and I don't say tabloidy to be dismissive. The allegations are serious, and they deserve to be investigating. I just mean tabloidy as a rather titillating story of political scandal. Ed Murray, the mayor of Seattle and one of the few openly gay politicians in the country, has been accused of raping and molesting a young man when he was younger, at least three, I believe, or I could be wrong on that. But at the very least, one current allegation, and this dates back to 1986, the middle 80s. The man was a high school dropout, addicted crack at the time, he said, and Murray was basically paying him $10 or $20 at the time, which doesn't seem like much, but it was the mid 80s, that money was worth more. I don't know what that is measured against inflation, for a little bit of sexy time fun. This has been a Well, My Northwest had a wonderful story about however the story turns out, whether it's true, whether it's false. Our reaction to it says a lot about us at this point, because some people who hate Murray will be cheering it. People who like Murray will be cheering for this to be false. And really, at any point, this is a very depressing story. Something sad has happened, whether it's true or not. One way or the other, something not all that fantastic has occurred. Either a good man's reputation has been dragged through the mud, or a man sexually preyed upon young impressionable addicts in their youth. He was under 18 at the time. JJ, you actually live in Seattle. Do you know what the discussion in the town is at this time?
I haven't heard a whole lot of people talking about it. I mean, yeah, my landlady was the first one to mention it to me a couple of days ago. And I kept forgetting to look into it pretty much until you posted the story. So yeah, I don't know. It's not big on my radar or a lot of people I've been talking to's radar. As always, these things are really tricky. I of course tend to side on the survivor account, of course. As I mentioned in the post, my landlady has assumed that it's some sort of conspiracy to discredit the mayor in the wake of filing a federal suit against the Trump administration for the sanctuary city defundings. So that's kind of the only thing I'm aware of that people are talking about, but that is a very, very small sample of my landlady. So I don't have, sadly, a whole lot about this.
Yeah.
To really put this in a way that examines Americans' cultural norms, JJ, I feel you on siding with the victim, and I believe that is, in general, the way people approach these things. I have noticed, though, when the victim is engaged in homosexual action, there is more of a response among the general public to trivialize this, to turn it into humor, to think of it as a less serious thing than it possibly is. And I'm just wondering, even in a city as liberal as Seattle is, if that is going to show its face and how we evaluate the story and what the public reactions are.
I mean, even the, you know, the first comment in that Jezebel article, it's like questioning whether it's abuse or prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I mean, right there, that's somebody trying to dismiss the entire circumstance as, you know, still technically illegal, but not that bad, which is extremely troubling, to say the least. Like, it's a very common tactic to misdirect the issue. You know, it would be the flagpole fallacy, you know, moving the flagpoles. Just, this is the issue instead.
I was just going to throw in here, this is all happening in the context of city election filing periods, which are just getting started. And actually, that was part of the mayor's office's response. I think what his attorney said was that he didn't think it was a coincidence that this was coming forward at this time. Murray has said previously that he plans to run for re-election. He's, as we've mentioned, he's a pretty liberal Democrat, but you know, actually in the context of Seattle politics, he's actually more on the conservative end of the spectrum of what you'd likely see in a citywide election.
He's known as a progressive warrior.
Sure.
And he is. I mean, but what Dan has said is true. Like,
he beat Mike
McGinn. As far as the country barometer is concerned, I mean, this is about as liberal a line as you get. You know, it's like this guy and Gavin Newsom, like they're the liberal lions.
It's great that you contextualize that for me, because Newsom was one of the more conservative Democrats on the city council in San Francisco.
Exactly.
That's the position.
It's such a good comparison. Like, in San, I mean, Gavin Newsom is amazing. And extremely progressive and very dreamy. Super handsome guy. And very, very progressive, given the nation's barometer. But from the locales in which they reside and are grown from, are remarkably centrist.
Yep.
The San Francisco City Council, I don't believe, has a single Republican member. It's mostly the more or less full-out communist versus the business-friendly Democrats, the ones who like banks. Mm-hmm. And Newsom was one of the ones who liked banks.
And that's basically Seattle, too.
Yeah, essentially, yeah, the same as... The city council gets chopped up between people who are friendly to Boeing and Microsoft while still, you know, tacitly supporting protests, and then, you know, Shama Sawant, who wants people on the street every weekend, and Boeing needs to pay 80% taxes and we need to quit subsidizing the company, that kind of a move.
Your story, Dan, that you posted about the guy in the bunny suit, I think some people want very nicely as a nationalized industries kind of socialist, not a burning socialist.
That was a great article. Oh, that was such a good story.
All right.
Yep.
And let's take our last moment here to stop in with Dan's bestest buddy ever,
State Senator Doug Erickson. Yeah.
When we last checked in, he was double dipping on his paychecks, working as both a state senator and a Trump administration appointee. What's changed now?
What's changed now is that it turns out, in addition to the salary that he's been collecting as a legislator, he is also collecting per diem. You know, so the funds that the state is supposed to pay legislators to cover their costs while they live in Olympia, away from their home, meals, everything, just, you know, the stuff that sustains them in addition to the salary that they're supposed to be paid. It's $120 a day. He's been collecting that for the entirety of this session, even though, again, he is working full time for the Trump White House or the Trump Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C. So it's another $6,000 that we didn't know he was claiming and getting paid by the state. Now he is. So yeah, he's just the best. He's my favorite. It's always something new. This is also the guy who was, he had bills earlier this year for, I believe, run over protesters was one of the things he was supporting after protesters blocked I-5 here in Bellingham. Back in January. So, yeah, always something great with Doug Erickson.
This is the kind of guy that like male glitter too was invented for.
Absolutely.
I do want to note this is one of the rare times, at least the article makes it seem like he is an hourly employee of the federal government.
Yeah,
they list a salary for his legislative act, but his EPA work is an hourly rate of $77.58, which sounds like good work. That's, if you can get it.
Yeah,
well, especially the since
the
one job
pays very well.
Oh. Yeah,
I mean,
but yeah, I guess combined between legislative salary and his government work and his per diem, they said he's going to clear $200,000 a year. And one of those is a job that he doesn't do. So. Nice work if you can get it.
So how likely is it that this Askeland gets voted out?
I think it's more likely that Trump will actually hire him on a permanent basis, and then it'll be expected that he'll resign. Because right now he's technically a transition employee. You know, so he's working for the EPA while they get more Trump appointees in place, and Trump is moving very slow in appointing people to any branch, but especially branches where he doesn't really care about enforcing anything. And one of those is, of course, going to be the EPA. So it'll probably move slowly, but I would expect before the next election cycle, he will actually be appointed to a job in the Trump administration.
You don't think he'll just try to do both jobs anyway?
He might. He honestly might.
Just collect both. I mean, he can just like phone in his vote if he cares to in the legislature, right?
I think by that point, Whatcom County Republicans would probably start to lose patience with him because they would like have a crack at the seat too.
I don't want to break the circle jerk and not blame something entirely on Trump. But while Trump has been slow to a point, there also has been a concerted effort to slow walk his nominees to the Senate by Democrats. That's not 100% Trump's fault. He has nominated far fewer people at this point than any president before him, but they've also been confirmed at a rather slow rate.
Oh, he's got rallies to go to, and he's got golf. So, you know, if people wanted to make
a lot of golf. Yeah. In the winter White House, it's hard to get appointments made there.
So that's another thing. We're kind of running to the end of the episode here. We're rambling. So I don't mind going off on a little bit of a tangent. That's something that's struck me as odd. Have you noticed that the symbolism Trump likes to use between his spirit animal presidents of Jefferson and Jackson? And think about the winter White House thing. There has been one president who used that formulation, and it was Kennedy. All three of those people are revered within the history of the Democratic Party. He has got to think about the political implications of who he's picking here. I don't think you really need to go as far as, like, what's your favorite food, and you'd better not say, you know, not broccoli. But there is a little bit of a symbolism problem. He keeps trying to drape himself in the lions and statues of the left and not the right, and I really feel like part of the inability of conservatives to really fully come around on Trump has to do at least a little bit with that.
Yeah, I feel like at his heart, he's always been a very conservative Democrat.
I get the impression he's just not that familiar with the Republican Party either. It was, I think, just a couple of weeks ago, he went off on just some crazy speech about how not many people know that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, that he was the first Republican president. You know, it translated.
It was like, dude, all Republicans.
Somebody just told me that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, you guys. Oh my God.
It's like, yeah, dude. And your party like rails on this all the time. You're like, we cared about black people this one time.
150 years
ago. When the Republican Party, like, wasn't even the Republican Party it is today. You know, yeah, before
the Whigs were still in the process of disintegrating at that point.
Yes, correct.
So, yeah, I could see that maybe he just doesn't have a lot of Republican heroes to go to. I mean, I guess he could. He doesn't really talk about Reagan the way most of them do. So that he's got to find somebody.
Yeah, I feel like if he glommed onto Reagan, it would be a bad image overall. It's
yeah.
Like two celebrity presidents, you know, one loving the other one isn't really, that doesn't cement you as like this rock, even though the GOP has built up Reagan after the fact to be just this phenomenal pillar of conservatism, you know.
Yeah.
They managed to rewrite history pretty well on that regard, but
Reagan had some enormously high approval ratings for a large part of his reign. It wasn't until the end of the 80s
sure.
that it started slipping. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Teflon Reagan, right? For sure.
Yeah.
He was an actor. He was an empty suit who could read lines. Absolutely.
He is one of the very few Republican presidents, probably along with Eisenhower, that can claim like actual popularity at some point during their reigns.
Yeah.
Bush cratered out with like, you know, 28% or something at the very end. And his high point was masked a little bit by 9/11. I don't think that was ever a real number. That was just an outpouring of patriotic fervor. But it's fairly clear that Bush was never super popular. There was a few years in the mid-80s where Reagan was pretty super popular. I think the GOP lionizes Reagan not out of desire to fake a myth, but there just aren't really many
other options
for them.
Oh, they just don't have really any success stories, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's Eisenhower was a communist, so they can't go with him.
Oh, God. That is how they remember him now. That's so weird.
Yep. Eisenhower is the Republican that all the Democrats like.
Exactly.
Well, that's true.
All right. Well, we'll go around the table. Well, it's not a literal table. We're all in different cities. But we'll go around the call.
Our mental table. and share the space with one another and sing Kumbaya.
JJ, come, bro. You should start doing those ASMR videos. You have a great voice for it.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah.
Never considered that at all.
Think about how much money you can make on YouTube.
Yeah, but then I'm doing ASMR.
You don't have to tell anybody. Pick a name that's, you know, different.
Wear a funny mask or something. Yeah, costumes.
That'll make it look like a fetish porn video.
That'll maybe make
it. It's a blurry line anyway.
Yeah, it seems pretty fair.
Well, we'll go around our virtual table then and talk about the stuff we're going to be following for this upcoming weekend or this upcoming week. I have a plentiful number of options this week. 200,000 people were without power in Portland. Some of them are still without power. We had a massive storm. Some people died, in fact. But I'm actually going to go with something that we already discussed on the Facebook group. There was a concerted attack on the city bike share program here in Portland, apparently carried out by some anarchist groups who are fairly active. I have videos of the anarchist groups showing up at the Trump protest and all that that I've shared on the Facebook page before. They are decently popular here as they are around the Northwest. They apparently took some issue with the fact that the Oregon Public Bike Share Program, the one owned and run by the city, is sponsored and funded by Nike. To express their dissatisfaction with that, they hit a couple dozen different bike stops, bike stations, I guess you would call them, defaced and took out of commission over 200 bicycles, spray painted all the signs, left flyers up saying our city is not your corporate amusement park. I'm a little bit flabbergasted. I think that was incredibly self-defeating. I get it. You don't like corporations. You can still not like corporations and acknowledge that they are allowed to care about the environment. Even if some don't, some do. This was self-defeating in so many ways. You have an actual progressive policy that is well used. People are riding bikes downtown instead of driving. These bikes get incredibly high usage. I know Seattle just shut down their bike share program. It didn't really work for them. It's working for us to the point where the numbers of riders have greatly exceeded the planned operating capacity. It is more popular than we thought it would be. This is working. This is cutting down on the number of cars on the road, the number of people who are contributing more pollution to the atmosphere, the environment. Why are you getting rid of that? Because you feel like Nike as a corporation isn't allowed to do good things for the environment? That's stupid to me. This whole thing.
Well, when you ride a Nike bike, they put a computer chip in your butt, bro.
Is that right?
The seat is right there. It could totally do it. Yeah.
It's just like one pothole away. You don't even notice it.
Oh, God. Well, that's the power. That's what I'm following this week. Really, really dumb anarchist. JJ, what are you looking at?
God damn it. I hate black box anarchists. They're such shit. Give anarchists a bad name. There's a good spirit of anarchy.
Super nutty. Like,
there are multiple amazing philosophical and like theoretical approaches to anarchism that are great. And those people are just like 17-year-old boys that have bats and inferiority complexes, and I want them all to go away. Yeah. Oh, they're terrible.
They took out apparently about a fifth of the bikes that are available through the Bike Down program. So that's one-fifth of the bikes out of commission until they get repaired.
Yeah. Let's see. I guess touching on my response to us bombing Syria, you know, and one of those things I mentioned kind of about the broader context as the show of force with Xi Jinping, with the meeting of Xi Jinping that weekend as well. The USS Carl Vinson strike group is headed towards the Korean Peninsula. So one of the things I linked to in that recontextualization was the show force also in regards to China's policy towards North Korea. And we've just moved a naval strike group right over to the Korean Peninsula. We're not messing around. This is that secondary push that I was looking for in terms of whether or not we were going to match force with more rhetoric. And it looks like it makes me feel like that bombing was more of a show of force strategically at the time than it was actually a direct attack against the Assad regime.
Did you notice the symbolism in which carrier group it was?
The Carl Vinson? No, I...
That's the carrier group that did war games with South Korea. The ones that North Korea always says are training for an invasion of North Korea.
Uh-huh. Gotcha.
It was the same carrier.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, so then because the crew is, of course, you know,
yeah,
knows the area.
Familiar. And they've already worked with the South Korean military to a large extent. I don't think that was unintentional. I think they're sending a carrier battle group that, if things go down, is the best trained, best positioned to actually handle this. They literally a couple months ago went through massive war games with most of the South Korean military. They have established communications channels. They know what's up. They know how they operate. It was most war
ready. They put the videos all over YouTube. There are like a bunch of videos of like high def videos of these war games on YouTube. They really, really went out of their way to make people know how freaking awesome these war games are.
Oh, fun times.
So aside from all of that, I'm playing Mass Effect Andromeda and it's boss. And that's mostly what I'm doing next.
Is it? I heard bad things.
I really loved the second and the third one.
Hmm.
I think the game is absolutely spectacular. It's a different quest style narrative, I think, than people are accustomed to. Like, especially in the wake of The Witcher, as they're both very big, very expansive narrative games. But The Witcher's quest lines are a lot more like D&D, like a beginning, middle of an end. Sometimes it touches to the larger world, sometimes it doesn't, but they're always pretty well self-contained stories, at times interrelated. Like, all of Mass Effect's thing is about being interrelated. Like, every moment is about the larger survivability of multiple species who have just made it to a new galaxy and are trying to make planets habitable. So yeah, it's really great for like little moments. You know, like I think like in The West Wing, like those really small moments, not the huge plot moments, but the small conversations that would sometimes happen between characters. Like, that's really where the narrative really rings well for me, in particularly Andromeda, but the earlier Mass Effect series as well.
Very nice.
Right on.
All right, Dan, how about you? What are you following this
week? All right. So I am not particularly surprised, but I am still particularly bummed that Mitch McConnell was able to successfully use the nuclear option and confirm.
Oh, Neil shit, we did not talk about that.
That's what my was. We were supposed
to talk
about
that. That was one of the other distractions that we were supposed to mention. Yeah.
I'll be distracting us from it now. So it's all right. That was the culmination of about a week of battle. The Democrats were able to filibuster, but of course McConnell managed to get through a rules change that would allow them to confirm Gorsuch on a simple majority vote. I think there's a lot to be said about how it's probably a good thing that the Senate can now do business, at least on this issue, on a majority vote basis, and I'd like to see it done for legislation as well. However, in this instance, Gorsuch just scares me on so many issues when it comes to civil rights, when it comes to worker protections, environmental protections, and we're going to have him for a very, very long time. You know, he's 49 years old. We're not too far off from seeing our contemporaries, you know, people our age appointed to the Supreme Court.
That's a scary thought.
Think about that. Yeah.
Wow.
That is the first millennial justice.
It's coming.
Myself.
It is coming. Anyhow, so
the best Twitter account ever.
Oh God. How do you get someone confirmed? I guess you have to have a 50 vote threshold. Otherwise, you couldn't get 60 votes for any millennial with a Twitter account or a Facebook feed that hasn't been combed thoroughly.
30
God,
years
I don't even want to think about what's on my MySpace.
Somebody on on MySpace or like your live journal, and you're like, oh shit, I have to defend my live journal from 1997. Yeah. Like,
I had to go and fiddle with my Facebook privacy settings, but even still, if I ever have to do anything like that, I'll be raked alive. But so what's going to be distracting me from Gorsuch this week anyhow is tomorrow night is the premiere of the third season of Better Call Saul, which
one
of my favorite shows on TV.
It's so good.
It reminds me very much of my 2 years or so in hardscrabble private practice when I first got out of school. So it gives me a little bit of flashbacks, but it all feels very familiar. I love it.
Did you hang up a sign on the street with your own office, or did you go to work for a firm when you first passed the bar?
I worked in a small firm with one other attorney.
Okay.
So he already, and I don't think we actually had a sign. We just had to kind of tell people where to go.
No, there was no sign.
No.
I lived in the other half of that building, Brock.
Exactly.
You visited me there.
Oh, that was that place in downtown Juneau?
Yeah, that the other half of that building was Dan's office.
That's hilarious. I have so many good memories of getting drunk and playing bocce ball on the PlayStation there.
Yeah, good times.
Well, that has been the April 9th edition of Cascadian Views. Goodbye, everybody.
Yeah, have a good night, guys. All right.